I'm Ken Rudin, and this is a special edition of The Political Junkie. Just ahead, a look back at great moments in the history of political conventions. Sure, you may think that conventions could be scripted and boring, but sometimes they could be inspiring.
Well, I think if you're talking about emotion and passion and people getting carried away, which they are prone to do far more than people remember at national conventions, that 76 is a beautiful example of how people got caught up after hearing Reagan.
Sometimes a convention speech will bring you to tears.
I don't even think I was really thinking very much. I was feeling so much the power of the crowd and their celebration and the sense that things were now forever changed.
And sometimes a convention can hit you close to home.
I felt sort of distant from the whole thing because, well, it wasn't anything new to me, okay? Number one. Number two, Tom was certainly a very functioning individual, so if he had some problems earlier, that wasn't anything I certainly was going to be dwelling on as we marched ahead.
We'll recall several of these great moments in convention history. The Political Junkie starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
The hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
Lipstick.
He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
All right. I'll start it, you finish it. Go ahead. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 136 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There was a time when the party's presidential nominees were decided at the conventions. In 1952, Adlai Stevenson walked into the Democratic Convention in Chicago as a non-candidate and came out of it as a nominee.
I accept your nomination and your program.
In 1924, Democrats took 17 days and 103 ballots to come up with a nominee. And in 1948, a pro-civil rights speech by Minneapolis Mayor Hubert Humphrey rocked the convention in Philadelphia.
To those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this. The time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
Humphrey's speech led to a walkout of many delegates from the South, who went on to hold a separate convention under the banner of states' rights and nominate South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond for president. Sometimes you'll hear a line from a presidential nominee that you may hear again many decades later, like this one from Ronald Reagan in 1980.
For those who've abandoned hope, we'll restore hope and we'll welcome them into a great national crusade to make America great again.
Since the advent of the modern primary system in 1972, most, but not all, of the convention drama has disappeared. The nominees were decided well in advance. The conventions became public relations spectacles, opportunities to rally the troops and unite the party, but with little news value. But there have been exceptions. There have been dramatic moments, and we'll hear from several reporters, activists, and even former candidates themselves about how those moments reshaped the parties and changed politics as we know it forever. Let's start with some drama. There have been conventions that have given delegates and those who covered them pure heartache. The 1964 Republican convention in San Francisco was certainly that and more. Partly because nominee Barry Goldwater had said things Republicans were not used to hearing.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And partly because of the booing Nelson Rockefeller received when he attacked the John Birch Society and the party's far right wing.
These are people who have nothing in common with Americanism. The Republican Party must repudiate these people.
The party left San Francisco divided, and it showed in November. Republicans suffered a landslide defeat. Another dramatic moment came for the Republicans in 1952. The GOP was frustrated, having lost five elections in a row to Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. They were especially peeved about the defeat in 1948, when Thomas Dewey was expected to win, but lost in the end to then-President Truman. The frustration was so great at that 52 convention in Chicago that Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois took it out on Dewey himself, wagging his finger at the New York governor.
When my friend Tom Dewey was the candidate in 44 and 48, I tried to be one of his best campaigners, and you ask him whether or not I didn't go into 18 states one year, 23 states the next. Re-examine your hearts before you take this action and support the minority report, because we followed you before, and you took us down the road to defeat, and don't do this to us.
Stephen Hess is Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Brookings Institution in Washington, but in 1952, he was a 19-year-old college student attending his first convention. Steve, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. I remember that moment when Dirksen spoke very well. I was there on the floor, and the noise you heard were half of the people booing Dirksen and half of the people booing Dewey. It was total chaos.
It sounded like Dirksen was itching for a fight, didn't it?
Oh, it sure did. Yeah, it sure did. Things were moving against his candidate, Robert Taft. Taft had come into that convention actually slightly ahead. The Eisenhower strategists were so clever. They had framed this whole debate as fair play. I couldn't figure out where the fair play was. It was standard politics at both times, but you sure wanted to have fair play on your side. So it was a fascinating example of where the campaign managers, the strategists, actually in the end won the nomination for their candidate.
And this was the first convention that was broadcast live on television, so the whole nation watched Dirksen's peak.
Yeah, first time it was nationally on television, wall to wall on television, and the first time the nation got used to Walter Cronkite.
But basically, what Dirksen, I mean, I think the part of the booing of Dewey was the fact that the Republicans kept losing even when they expected to win, and Dirksen was, you know, was afraid that, look, Dewey, you took us down to the road to defeat twice, and now you're going to probably do the same thing with your backing of Eisenhower. Is that basically what it was?
I think there was a little more vitriol to it there. In other words, this was in the middle of a debate where it was becoming very clear that his man, Mr. Republican, Taft, who had gone into the convention actually slightly ahead, was now put in a very untenable position. So it wasn't just looking back to Dewey, it was blaming Dewey for putting the Eisenhower camp in such a position that that wing of the party, and remember, you're talking about two ideological wings of the party, was going to win the nomination. So you had a situation in which the old guard deserved Taft. Taft had led them all through these miserable years, and suddenly along comes this new person. We didn't even know that he was a Republican, named Dwight Eisenhower, five-star general, and he pulls the rug right out from under them. So it was a fascinating moment, and of course, the point was that Eisenhower could win. And it was very problematical about whether Taft could. So it was turning out the dear fellow who had worked so hard for you in favor of this gorgeous new person who was going to lead you to the promised gate.
Yeah, I don't want to compare him to Donald Trump, but when you're talking about Eisenhower as this outsider, this new gorgeous person with tenuous ties to the Republican Party, and who also never ran for office before, do you see any?
I see absolutely none. You're not going to put me in that position. He may not have run for office, but he had spent his life in public service as a five-star general. He knew the workings of the Pentagon, particularly, and of government, as well as anybody who had come up, through elective politics. So the joy of Eisenhower was that he could claim not to be a politician, but knew really in a strange way all the wiles of the politician.
Thank you for saving me from the worst comparison I could have made in my entire life.
Fair enough.
Listen, but you know, you think of the emotion, you listen to Dirksen's speech, you think of the emotion at that convention, but it didn't seem like it split the party. It seemed like it was united after that convention in Chicago.
For a very good reason, and that reason was Robert Taft. They didn't come out of that convention as happy warriors by any means. They were damn bad. But between that convention in early July and when the campaign really started at Labor Day, Bob Taft had put his people back on track. He was the real hero of this. They had to go into that election united. That was the key. They had the right candidate, but they also had the right opponent in Harry Truman, but they also had to have a united party, and that's what Bob Taft did for them.
It's sad to think that right after the election and Taft was elected a Senate Majority Leader, he died not that long later, much later, of cancer.
Yes, it was sad. Not only sad for the nation, but very sad for Dwight Eisenhower, the president. He had some very difficult Republicans that he had to keep in line, particularly Midwest Republicans, and Bob Taft was the perfect person to do that. And when he died, Eisenhower had a lot of problems from his own right wing.
So Eisenhower won in 1952. It was a very successful convention. He won handily in November. Whatever happened to Stephen Hess?
Oh, his student in school, you know, how to get a degree, how to go into the Army, how to come out of the Army, and eventually was on the White House staff of that same person, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Stephen Hess is Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Brookings Institution in Washington. I think 1952 was his first convention. His latest book is America's Political Dynasties, From Adams to Clinton. Steve, thanks so much for remembering that great convention of 1952.
Well, it's like your first love, you know, your first convention. Very special.
One more note of drama and anger worth mentioning. This may have been the most emotional of all. It's 1968. The Democrats are meeting in Chicago. It was an awful year. The war in Vietnam going on, and the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy. Anti-war protesters were marching in the streets outside the International Amphitheater and were battling with the Chicago police. Inside the convention hall, Vice President Hubert Humphrey was on his way to winning the nomination, despite not having won or even entered a single primary. Talk about a rigged convention. Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut was giving a nominating speech on behalf of George McGovern, the South Dakota senator who made himself available after Kennedy's assassination.
As I look at the confusion in this hall and watch on television the turmoil and violence that is competing with this great convention for the attention of the American people, there is something else in my heart tonight, and not the speech that I am prepared to give.
And then Ribicoff took his anger even further.
And with George McGovern as President of the United States,
we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago.
The hall erupted. Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley screamed at Ribicoff. Some 16 years ago, I had the honor of interviewing George McGovern about Ribicoff's speech. Here are some excerpts.
He captured the spirit of everything that was going on, both inside the convention hall and out in the street. And he knew that he had scored heavily by the tremendous applause he got even inside the convention hall. And more to the point, he knew what was going on in radio land and in television land outside of the hall. I was very proud of Senator Ribicoff. He made that speech extemporaneously and cast aside his prepared text. But if there was ever a case of a politician seizing the moment, Senator Ribicoff did that in 1968.
That was my conversation with George McGovern back in 2000. In 1968, his name was put into nomination at the Democratic Convention in Chicago by Senator Abraham Ribicoff.
In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready.
We talked about drama, but sometimes we forget that it can also be personal. Let's go to 1972. George McGovern, who failed in his long-shot bid to win the nomination 4 years earlier, won it in 72. And his choice for running mate was Senator Thomas Eagleton of Missouri.
Most of us did not expect to nominate a man who began with only 5% in the polls. Few expected our convention to be orderly and so productive. And surely I did not expect to stand before you tonight as the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. It is thus with deep humility in the face of the responsibility you've asked me to assume, and with profound gratitude to you, the delegates, and of course to Senator McGovern, that I accept your nomination.
As for the convention being orderly, well, it really wasn't. Eagleton didn't begin his acceptance speech until after 2 a.m. And first he had to undergo a bizarre roll call procedure that included votes for 78 other VP hopefuls, such as, and I'm not making this up, Archie Bunker, Mao Zedong, Martha Mitchell, and Jerry Rubin. But that wasn't even the worst part. It was soon revealed that Eagleton had been hospitalized for depression and had undergone electroshock therapy to treat it. And that became such a scandal at the time that McGovern, even though he said he was 1,000% behind Tom Eagleton, forced him off the ticket 18 days later. As for Eagleton, he remained wildly popular back home, winning 2 more Senate terms before retiring in 1986. He led the efforts to halt the U.S. bombing in Cambodia and opposed giving the president the authority to go to war without congressional approval. Tom Eagleton died in 2007. Barbara Ann Smith married Tom Eagleton in 1956. I met her years ago when I was giving a speech in St. Louis, and I've asked her this week to share her memories of that most tumultuous time. Barbara Eagleton, thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Glad to do this.
Well, I hope so. And I really appreciate us talking about some of this difficult time back in 72. Look, that was a tough time for the Democrats. It was a tough convention for the Democrats as well. Do you remember when you got your first inkling that Tom was first being considered for vice president?
Well, we had planned to go to the convention in Miami maybe 3 or 4 months before, but and just before we left to go, there was a little kind of talk about, you know, maybe Tom being on the long list, but I don't think he took it seriously, and I didn't either. You know, there were a lot of people that were potentials, and Tom was fairly new to the Senate then. Actually, I think we'd only been in Washington 4 years, So I think we both sort of dismissed it, but it was kind of flattering. So I liked it.
Do you remember where you were when you found out that he was the guy?
That he was the guy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had stayed with the Missouri delegation at the Ivanhoe Hotel in Miami. And that's when McGovern called him and asked him to be on the ticket. I think after a few of our good Senate friends, senators, had turned it down, he was just fishing around for somebody sort of quickly so he could put the credentials in. I think the credentials had to be in by 2 in the afternoon. It was a little crazy. I mean, it all happened, in my estimation, it happened pretty fast because I wasn't really thinking in terms of this. We went to Miami, although, as I say, there had been a little bit of scuttlebutt, but so many people were in that kind of, you know, there were just a lot of people that were maybe interested in it or other people were interested in having them be part of the maybes.
Not much longer after the convention ended, the party was in an uproar over Tom's health history. I can't imagine what it must have been like for the family. What can you tell me?
I think at the time I said it really wasn't, I felt sort of distant from the whole thing because, well, it wasn't anything new to me, okay, number one. Number two, Tom was certainly a very functioning individual, so if he had some problems earlier, that wasn't anything I certainly was going to be dwelling on as we marched ahead. And so when it happened, I must say I took it as either, you know, kind of pretty casually. Maybe a lot of people wouldn't have, but that's just my makeup. And even though there was this big whirl of news and people around, I think I told you once before, I felt like I was in the middle of this great storm, and I was the center of it, and I just, while it swirled around me, I just remained kind of calm and watched events happen, and if I was needed to do anything, just fine, but it didn't have that great an impact on me. The fact is that I didn't really want Tom to do this, to accept the governor's invitation. I said, I think, you know, you should stick to the Senate career, because I always thought he would do that, and I wanted him to stay there, and I loved Washington, and I thought Tom would be a really great senator. So I wasn't too happy about this.
I do remember you telling me that it almost felt like you were in the middle of a tornado when all these swirling winds were all around you, and inside it was just completely calm.
It was. I guess it's because nothing was new to me, and I knew it would all calm down. It's just that's this kind of life. Although that was a long time ago, and I was much, much younger, but somehow it didn't have the upsetting factor that you might expect. I guess it's just my nature. I don't know, but it was pretty darn interesting.
Well, I remember your husband clearly wanted to fight it out. Here he is campaigning in California.
To drive them out of office. I'm not quitting. I'm not getting out. We're going to win this election, and I'm going to be the next vice president of the United States.
Well, at some point, it was clear that he was on the losing end of that argument. And so when it was over, when he did resign from the ticket, did you feel relief, anger, betrayal, everything, all the above?
No, I think I felt relief. I mean, I didn't know the McGoverns. I didn't know Eleanor at all, which is surprising because I knew a lot of Senate-wise. But I knew George, and I liked him very much. You know, if that's what he thought he should do. I mean, I think he was reluctant. He was very reluctant to have to drop Tom from the ticket. I know that. And he told us all about his family, and a depression isn't that unusual, shall we say. But in any case, I liked him very much, but he just felt that the ticket needed Tom off it, and he needed to have somebody else, that there was, even though it would have been the main focus for him, certainly, that it seemed to be with the press, and that's just the way it is. That's part of the political process. So, I mean, once George said that he would like Tom to step down, Tom said, absolutely.
I do remember that years later, McGovern said he regretted dumping your husband from the ticket. He said that nobody understood anything about mental illness back then.
Well, the McGoverns did. But, you know, that was then. Yeah, that's true.
Did your husband and McGovern have any relationship in the years afterwards? Or was everything okay?
Yeah, I think everything was fine. And actually, he came here. He called Tom and said the Cardinals were his baseball club. He used to listen to all the Cardinal games, so he called and he said he'd like to come to St. Louis and go to a Cardinals game. I can't remember which one it was, but anyway, then he said, well, where can I stay? Tom said, is he okay? Is it all right if I invite him to stay here? And I said, well, of course. Anyway, they went to the game. I stayed home. Then when they get back, we stayed up and talked late. And the next morning, he was gone early because I get up early, and he was gone by 6. And he left a nice long note. That was the last I ever heard from him. I think by that time, Eleanor was no longer with us.
Obviously, this happened a long time ago, but you don't seem to wince when people like me coming around asking you about those days.
No, I don't, if I can remember everything. Let's see, that was, oh my God, that's 44 years ago. I'm glad I can still remember a lot of details.
I am thrilled that you've come on our program to talk about this. Barbara Eagleton, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
You're most welcome. Since you gotta go,
nothing was going to help McGovern's campaign against President Nixon in 1972. He wound up losing 49 states. And perhaps nothing was going to help Walter Mondale when he challenged President Reagan in 1984. He also lost 49 states. But for a brief moment, at the Democratic Convention that year in San Francisco, history was being made.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro.
It had to be one of the most riveting moments in convention history. Ferraro was a Democratic member of Congress from Queens, New York, in her third term, and she was the first woman in political history to appear on a major party ticket. Judy Goldsmith at that time was the president of the National Organization for Women, a group founded to fight for women's rights. Judy, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ken. It's a pleasure.
You know, I mean, I was on that convention floor that day in San Francisco, and I felt the emotion and the history, and my heart was pounding. But for somebody like you who's been fighting for women, you know, for all these years, I can't even imagine what you must have been going through.
It is really hard to put it in words. I have a video of that event, of her acceptance speech for the nomination. And I have used that often in speaking with college classes about her remarkable candidacy. The images of the women on the floor looking up at her with tears streaking their faces will forever remain in my memory and my heart. And one thing that was especially interesting about that particular moment was that Democratic convention rules required that there be an equal number of male and female delegates. But that night, most of the men yielded their credentials to women alternates. So almost everyone on the floor was women. And there was a joy and a celebration that is unforgettable and difficult to put into words.
And lots of tears.
Oh, yes, lots of tears.
Well, you described the scene around you. What was going inside of Judy Goldsmith? I mean, what were you feeling?
I had left my now contingent and gone to the Wisconsin delegation because I wanted to be, quote, home, unquote, for that remarkable moment. I don't even think I was really thinking very much. I was feeling so much the power of the crowd and their celebration and the sense that things were now forever changed. You know, as a reminder, that was 32 years ago. And at that time, this possibility was truly remarkable. I mean, people really weren't considering. I mean, as I know you know, Ken, we are way behind the rest of the world in having women leaders, women heads of state. But at that time, 1984, it was still really considered a little iffy. Like, hello, folks, here's something new. The world has changed, and we're not going back again.
As the head of the National Organization for Women, did you have any conversations about the possibility of her being on the ticket with Congresswoman Ferraro in advance?
Oh, yes, we definitely did. And in fact, she appeared at our national convention that year and spoke. You can imagine what the National Organization for Women National Conference was with Geraldine Ferraro on the stage when we knew that there was a strong possibility that she would be chosen, although at that point it had not been confirmed. But yes, we did talk about it, and she was excited at the possibility, but also very confident that it was something her background and her entire life really prepared her to do, so she wasn't worried about that, but she was excited at the possibility.
You know, last year I had Walter Mondale on The Political Junkie, and he had this to say about his selection.
I spent a lot of time reviewing who I might pick as a running mate, and as I got down to it, I decided that Ferraro would help in so many ways. She's, first of all, she's bright. She had an excellent record in the Congress. Tip O'Neill told me she's the person you need. And I was hoping that she would give some life to the process. You know, one of the big problems in politics is boredom. And this offered to America an entirely different version of what America should be about. And I think, although we got clobbered, I think that the message was sent that was deep and profound.
Judy, there was no boredom at that 84 convention.
No, there was no boredom at all. And you're using the quotation from Vice President Mondale reminds me that when he made the announcement of Geraldine Ferraro as his selection for vice president, he made that in the legislative chambers of the Minnesota state legislature. As he introduced her, he said, "I searched for the best vice president, and I found her in Geraldine Ferraro." And I felt that the word "her" hung in the air for a couple moments because it was the first time that that had been spoken. And the room, of course, completely erupted. It was just a remarkable time.
Is that your favorite convention of all time?
Absolutely. Oh, without question, it's my favorite of all time. I've been to a few others, but there's nothing that tops that.
Obviously, that high didn't last that long. I remember within days there were questions about Ferraro's husband's real estate deals, and there were complaints about abortion. And I just remember that high moment at that speech in San Francisco didn't last as long as it could have. And, of course, as Mondale pointed out in that little quote I played, the ticket wound up losing 49 states, but when you think of that 84 convention, you don't think of the result in November. You think of that amazing moment.
Yes, and, you know, you mentioned the so-called scandals about her husband's real estate dealings. That was completely fraudulent. The opposition, you know, that was when opposition tactics were really coming into their own. The opposition dug into not only Ferraro's background, but her entire family's background, going back three generations to find something that they could pin on her. And all they came up with was this weak and meaningless so-called charge against her husband, John Zaccaro, for his real estate practices. There was a smear campaign that was unrelenting. But in spite of that, she managed a campaign that had dignity and integrity, and with her wonderful queen sense of humor intact.
Did you ever talk to her after that convention about that moment?
Oh, yes. And she had so many wonderful memories. She said that she got so many letters, and she spoke of one from a woman who said, "Congresswoman Ferraro, I was so very excited to hear the news of your nomination that I ran upstairs to tell my sleeping daughters that history was changed forever." They were only 2 years old, so they didn't quite understand the impact of it, but someday they will. And she also said that after the election was over and she started to fly on planes like a normal human being again, she said she missed getting onto a plane and hearing people chant, "Jerry, Jerry," and chuckled about that. But she was most grateful for the experience.
In 1984, Judy Goldsmith was the president of the National Organization for Women. She's also the former dean at the University of Wisconsin at Fond du Lac. Judy, it was just great having you on the show. I'm thrilled that you were there, and thanks for sharing that amazing memory.
And my pleasure, Ken. Thank you for the opportunity.
My name is Judy Goldsmith. I'm president of the National Organization for Women. In choosing Geraldine Ferraro to be his running mate, Walter Mondale has made the kind of bold, progressive move that will propel the Democratic ticket to victory in November. The Mondale-Ferraro ticket will provide a daily, visible reminder of the contrast between Walter Mondale, the candidate dedicated to breaking down the barriers that women and minorities face, and Ronald Reagan, the candidate determined to create new ones. Mondale's choice reaffirms his sound political judgment, his refusal to allow gender to bar the best candidate, and his historic and unprecedented commitment to equality for all the citizens of this nation. We are prouder today of the now PAC endorsement of Walter Mondale than we have ever been before, and we are confident of victory in November.
Democrats were devastated by their landslide defeat in 1984. They were determined not to repeat their mistakes in 1988. In that year's convention in Atlanta, they nominated Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis for president.
Tonight, as a son of immigrants, with a wonderful wife, and now with Lisa, our lovely daughter-in-law, four terrific children, and as a proud public servant who has cherished every minute of the last 16 months on the campaign trail, I accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Last summer, we had Governor Dukakis on The Political Junkie to reflect on that 1988 convention. Here's part of that interview.
I remember one of the biggest questions and the biggest conversations going into the convention was the process for choosing a running mate. And we all watched that trek of hopefuls going to Brookline. Would it be John Glenn? Would it be Dick Gephardt, Lloyd Benson, Bob Graham?
Al Gore.
Al Gore was on the list, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Mondale did the same thing. I don't know if it felt unseemly or did it feel like a ritual, but obviously you had to find out who you wanted on your ticket.
Remember, we were all still very much aware of what happened to George McGovern and Tom Eagleton. And that was the last thing in the world we wanted. And Bronis laid out a very detailed approach to this and a detailed process, which involved inviting anybody and everybody to recommend suggestions, gradually narrowing the field down, as I did, to four. And then, with respect to those four, who happened to be Lloyd Benson, Al Gore, John Glenn, and Dick Gephardt. Those were the four finalists, if you will. Now, why Benson? Well, it's hard to kind of describe this, but there's something about the process. And, of course, I had picked lots and lots of people as governor. I was in my 10th year as governor, and I liked that process. I liked picking good people. And when it was all said and done, any one of those four people would have been excellent running mates, but it just seemed that Lloyd was the right guy, and he turned out to be a terrific running mate. I mean, if I'd done better on my side, he could have made the difference.
I think the criticism at the time was that on several issues, the two of you were miles apart. Maybe you were as far apart with Lloyd Benson as you were with George Bush.
No, not miles apart. I mean, there were very few differences. And on some things like health care, for example, he was terrific.
Right, but there were the Contras, there was the MX missile, there was...
Who remembers the MX missile?
Right, exactly.
And the midget man.
Right.
Only you and I are old enough to remember that controversy, right?
We're really still very young. One of the highlights of the convention, I thought, was the keynote speech of then-Texas State Treasurer Ann Richards. She charmed the delegates from the get-go. Here's a piece of tape.
I'm delighted to be here with you this evening because after listening to George Bush all these years, I figured you needed to know what a real Texas accent sounds like.
And then she had that great line about having women as keynote speakers.
But if you give us a chance, we can perform. After all, Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did. She just did it backwards and in high heels.
And if that wasn't enough, there was this memorable zinger about the Republican standard bearer.
Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
Where were you watching that speech?
In a hotel room. Yeah, she was wonderful. And how the hell George W. Bush beat her for governor is beyond me. She was an extremely popular governor.
Well, I just remember standing on the floor of the convention there, everybody just saying that this is one of the great keynote speeches of all time, and people really reacted. But as I'm thinking here, just because some lines were memorable doesn't mean they went over well. There was a governor of Arkansas, a guy by the name of Bill Clinton. He seemed to go on forever in his speech nominating you. Here he is, still talking away 32 minutes into his speech.
I had a professor in college who told me that the sole reason for America's greatness was that our people have always believed the future could be better than the present, and that we've always done what it took to secure it. And he said, look, if we ever get to the point where our parents don't prefer their children's future to their present, we've had it, and don't you ever forget it. Michael Dukakis will never, never, never forget it. In closing,
those two words, in closing, were probably the most welcome words anybody at the convention ever heard.
And here's a story you probably don't remember or maybe haven't heard, but when Clinton decided to announce the presidency in the fall of 1991, Ken, he decided to do it on the Johnny Carson show.
I remember that.
Remember that?
With the hourglass, right? The hourglass?
Right. And Carson said, why are you running? You know what he said?
Yeah.
Because I want to finish my speech with Dukakis.
Well, as you were sitting watching, Ann Richards, what was your reaction when you were watching Bill Clinton? I mean, were you checking your watch?
It wasn't his fault. We had gone over his speech. I had, others had. We said, that's fine. We just misjudged the fact that it was too long. So don't blame him. I mean, we all signed off on it. And it was one of those speeches that read well, but it was just too long.
Whatever happened to him?
Well, he did pretty well, actually.
That was former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis speaking with me last summer about the 1988 Democratic Convention. As we saw with Ann Richards and Geraldine Ferraro, you can have a successful convention with emotional speeches and still lose the election in November. But great convention moments are just that. It's less about winners and losers. It's about being moved, about being touched. Think about a speech a defeated Ted Kennedy gave in New York in 1980.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
It was emotional and heart-wrenching, and he lost. Here's another example. Ronald Reagan swept to the Republican nomination in 1980, trouncing President Carter in November, but 4 years earlier he failed in his bid for the nomination, losing narrowly to President Gerald Ford. Ford was an accidental president, having succeeded to the vice presidency and then the presidency because of scandals and resignations. Reagan had an uphill battle, but he came close. Ford, knowing he needed to unite the party, had Reagan come to the podium to speak to the delegates in Kansas City.
We are all a part of this great Republican family that will give the leadership to the American people to win on November 2nd. I would be honored on your behalf to ask my good friend, Governor Reagan, to say a few words at this time.
The convention erupted, and Reagan did not let them down.
We must go forth from here united, determined that what a great general said a few years ago is true. There is no substitute for victory. Mr. President.
Lee Edwards is a distinguished fellow in conservative thought at the Heritage Foundation and a leading historian of American conservatism. He's written some 25 books, including Reagan, A Political Biography, which I read in 1967. Lee, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much, Ken. Good to be with you.
1967 was just yesterday, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I remember it so well.
You know, I'm wondering if you found it odd that I'm focusing first on Reagan's unsuccessful bid for the nomination in 76 and not on his winning bid in 1980.
Well, I think if you're talking about emotion and passion and people getting carried away, which they are prone to do far more than people remember at national conventions, that 76 is a beautiful example of how people got caught up after hearing Reagan make that marvelous so-called impromptu remarks about looking back from 2076, back on a century earlier, and how did the people do at that time. I say so-called because, you know, Ken, I've always felt that what we heard was the core of Reagan's acceptance speech if he had won the nomination.
Lee, I was just going to ask you that. To me, when I hear that speech over and over again, it sounded like an acceptance speech.
Yes, and I never had a chance to ask him that question. I kicked myself for not doing it. And I don't think I've ever heard or seen or read Lou Cannon or any of the other, Craig Shirley or the other very good biographers, whether they've approached this thing. But I've always and become increasingly convinced that that, in fact, was what he would have said if he had been nominated.
When I think of the state of the country and also the state of the Republican Party in 1976, obviously I think of Nixon and Ford and Watergate and the pardon. Do you think it was almost better that Reagan didn't win the nomination that year? Because that would have been a tough year for Republicans.
Well, I think so. And I think, as a matter of fact, that I wouldn't say nobody, but it certainly, I think that Reagan would have been hard-pressed to defeat Jimmy Carter, might have, might not have. But if he had won, I don't think he would have been able to initiate many of the reforms that he was able to in 1980, because by then we'd had 4 years of the Carter presidency, which was not the most successful that we've had in the last 50 years. And I think the people were ready for a change. They were ready for his kind of populism / traditional conservatism.
You know, when I think of the Barry Goldwater defeat in 1964, I mean, that may have been the beginning of the modern conservative movement in Republican presidential politics, but I never felt there was anything really noble about Goldwater's defeat, but there was something about Reagan's defeat in 76 for the conservatives that felt promising.
Well, I think if you remember what he said in that time, he said that, yes, I'm wounded and I'm laying down and I'm bleeding, but I shall rise and rise to fight again. And he energized people with those remarks. I happen to have been there, and people were crying, they were sobbing, they thought this was the end. And he reached out and said, no, it's not over. We will rise and fight again. And we know that this was in the summer of 76. The following January, at a meeting with Richard Allen, who turned out to be his national security advisor, Reagan and he talked about the Cold War. And that's when Reagan came up with his famous formulation about, I have a way of ending the Cold War. We win and they lose. And Dick Allen was so excited about that. He said, well, if you really truly mean that, Governor, and I assume you do, I want to be on your team. So Reagan was already thinking about running again, even though he had been so narrowly defeated, and even though many of the experts said, well, that's the end of Ronald Reagan.
I was not at the 1976 convention, but I was at the one in 1980. That was my first convention, and I do remember the day before, the night before, the session before Reagan was nominated, he came unexpectedly because there were all these rumors about him picking Gerald Ford as his running mate, and he came to the podium and said, look, I'm not supposed to be here, but I just want to announce that I'm picking George Bush as my running mate, and the place went wild. That was the emotion I felt in 1980.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, there was that, but prior to that was not as strong an emotion, but many people were swept away by the idea of the so-called dream ticket, which would have been Ronald Reagan and Gerry Ford, who was, had been president. And so people were seriously considering this. Many people on Reagan's staff, as well as Ford's staff, liked the idea very much. And then all of a sudden, I remember that Mr. Ford went on the Walter Cronkite show talking about it, and Cronkite said something like, well, Mr. President, this sounds an awful lot like a co-presidency to me. What do you think? And Ford said, well, you know, Walter, you're probably right. And I know that Reagan was watching that at the time, and he went absolutely, he said, oh, well, that's not what I want, a co-presidency. And he picked up the phone almost on the spot and said, get me George Bush, which he did, and invited him to be his running mate.
You know, of course, there were three conventions that Reagan was obviously very prominent in. The 1984 one with his reelection, although I kind of forget that one because it wasn't exciting at all. But if you want to compare the two big Reagan conventions of 76 when he lost and when he won in 1980, how do you see the two differently?
Well, I think in 1976, he was still not quite at his summit as a national politician, almost there, and as we know, almost defeated an incumbent president, which quite an extraordinary thing. And I think also the times were not yet ready for him, as I've indicated and suggested, whereas in 1980, everything came together. Reagan is sort of at his prime, the people looking for new answers and a new kind of leadership, the disappointing Carter presidency, both in the domestic area and also in the foreign policy area. All of those things came together in 1980. So I think, to me, and I think for conservatives, this was a culmination of what had the conservatives have been working toward since 1964 in the landslide defeat of Barry Goldwater.
Lee Edwards is a distinguished fellow in conservative thought at the Heritage Foundation. Lee, thanks so much for sharing your memories.
My pleasure, Ken. Thanks so much for asking me.
Conventions may not be chock full of surprises and drama like they used to be, but in our strange, sometimes surreal way we pick our presidential nominees, they have over the years made us laugh and cry and shake our heads in amazement, and they will never be forgotten. Obviously, there are so many more great convention moments that we wish we could have included in this show, so we'll be featuring several more of them on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And while you're there, be sure to follow us throughout this year's Republican and Democratic conventions for extensive coverage and insightful conversations in both Cleveland and Philadelphia. That's it for this week's show. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening.